Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you're just tuning in, sorry about my voice. I will get through today with tea and honey. You will get through it with great guests who will do most of the talking. If you are just tuning in, I actually sound a little better than I did a half hour ago. But this week we've been talking about the death over the weekend of the Cuban revolutionary and longtime leader of the country, Fidel Castro, and what it might mean for the future of Cuba and the future of Cubans here and U.S.-Cuba relations. We have a very special guest now, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs and native Cuban, Jose Fernandez, who is now the co-chair of the law firm Gibson Dunn's Latin American Practice Group. Mr. Fernandez, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for coming on.
Good morning, Brian. Delighted to be here.
And, of course, we don't know yet what President-elect Trump is going to change with respect to U.S.-Cuba policy. But maybe you can remind everybody what Obama has actually changed that did not exist before.
So for about 55 years, the U.S. had an embargo with Cuba. U.S. citizens couldn't travel unless they were people like me, Cuban Americans. You couldn't really do any business in Cuba. Then in December of 2014, Obama basically changed that. He changed it without having to change the law. The law that governs Cuban relations and that has the embargo is the Helms-Burton Act and a couple of others. But in 2014, Obama changed the regulations. He could do it without getting congressional approval, and he started liberalizing slowly and not totally, but liberalizing slowly the ability of U.S. citizens to travel to Cuba, and also some specific business deals that could be done in Cuba. But a lot of the obstacles remain. But Obama started the process, and obviously by traveling to Cuba, he was able to do something that he had been talking about for a long time, which was deal directly with the Cuban people. People-to-people contact and look for ways to try and address the Cuban people without having to go through the government. And that was important because one of the basic tenets of the Cuban Revolution is that the U.S. is the evil empire. And one of the things that he could show was that an African-American president in the greatest, in the largest democracy in the world, could actually would be interested in Cuba and was someone who that the Cuban people could deal with and could identify with. So he started the process, and obviously one of the questions we have now is what happens after January 20th with that policy.
Since you're Cuban or Cuban American yourself, and there's so much opposition to, or at least ambivalence about, Obama's opening to Cuba. Do you feel ambivalent at all yourself?
I personally do. I support the Obama policy. I realize that, and no one really had any illusions that the Castros were angels. But I think, from a U.S. point of view, I think the ability to deal directly with the Cuban people to try and also eliminate an irritant in U.S. Latin American relations. Every time we went to a meeting in Latin America, the issue of Cuba came up, and the U.S. was more and more isolated on the Cuba issue in this hemisphere. So by removing that issue from our dealings with Latin America, and also finding ways to basically start a debate and a dialogue with the Cuban people. You know, for 55 years, we basically weren't talking to them, and we couldn't have the debate that I think President Obama was able to begin by opening relations. But so I am ambivalent, but I also realize that after 55 years of something that wasn't working, and where the U.S. really had less and less influence in Cuba, it was time to try something else. And I think it's worked. If you look at some changes in Cuba, I think the Cuban people are much more willing to look at U.S.-Cuban relations, and actually, I think most of them realize that the U.S. would be a great partner to have. And I think the Obama visit, the opening of relations, has been quite popular in Cuba. and also, frankly, has also been very popular in here in the U.S. Most public opinion polls will tell you that Americans want relations with Cuba, want to be able to travel to Cuba. So that by removing that, I think U.S. policy has changed for the better. And so I am ambivalent on the personal basis. I lost friends. I was a young boy when I left Cuba, but I still remember some of the things that happened, and they weren't pretty. But the question that you ask yourself is, you know, how do you move forward? And I think that's something that Obama did, and I hope it continues.
My guest is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Jose Fernandez, and we can take phone calls from Cuban Americans or anyone else at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you think the death of Fidel Castro will mean anything in and of itself for Cubans, or is that, you know, whatever change is going to happen is already baked in because his brother Raul has been running the country for years?
Yeah, Fidel had been out of office for the last 10 years, and basically his presence was seen only in newspaper articles that he wrote once or twice a month. So he hasn't had much of an influence. I think his death, what it brings home to Cubans is that the world has changed and that a new era is beginning. And I think it drives that point home. But from a from the point of view of Cuba and U.S. relations, I don't think it changes much.
On Monday, Donald Trump tweeted, "If Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people, and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate deal." Do you understand what he's asking for in terms of a better deal?
Well, that's a broader question, right? I mean, I think I've given up trying to interpret what Donald Trump is saying. But I think what he was proposing was a return to the past. For a long time, every president from Kennedy forward and had basically said that if Cuba changed, if they did A, the U.S. would do B. So it was always a quid pro quo, and it never worked. And the Cuban government was quite happy to leave it that way. They could have the status quo, and they could keep using the U.S. as a foil for all of their failures. So Trump wasn't really proposing anything new, and I think there are many people in Cuba, in the old guard, that would welcome a return to the past, that would welcome a much more adversarial relationship with the U.S. I don't know if Trump is going to go forward with this. I think, if anything, if he wanted to change course, he could say that now that Castro has died, he's going to wait and see how Cuba changes. But I think trying to cut a deal, as he would say, with a different deal with Cuba, I think would basically bring us back. And so I don't think he would do it. I also don't think that Latin America generally, and Cuba in particular, is quite high on his agenda. So I would not expect them to do something immediately. But what it has done is it has injected an uncertainty into U.S.-Cuban relations that I think is going to make it more difficult for U.S. businesses and U.S. Colleges and universities to try and reach out to the Cuban people in the way that President Obama was hoping to encourage.
Skeptics of the Obama opening say he could have used more leverage to get more political freedoms for the Cuban people. And that seems to be some of what Trump is suggesting there.
Right. And that's exactly what they say. But I think part of the change in thinking that Obama brought to the issue was that he wasn't going to do this because it benefited Cuba. He was going to do it because having relations with Cuba helped the U.S. And only by having a presence, physical or otherwise, in Cuba could the U.S. have an impact in the changes that are sure to come in Cuba. So he didn't want to have to fight the ideological fight with a hand tied behind his back, which is what we had when we couldn't do anything in Cuba, when we didn't have anybody there. So I think Obama Obama's philosophy was, we're going to do this because it's good for the U.S. It's going to remove a problem with our Latin neighbors, and it's also going to allow us to deal directly with the Cuban people and have an impact in Cuba, not through the government, but directly. And I think, obviously, it would help if the Cuban government had done more on the human rights front. But I think it's fair to say that that we had no illusions, that we thought that this was the best course of action for the U.S. in the long term.
My guest is Jose Fernandez, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, now the co-chair of the Latin America Practice Group at the law firm Gibson Dunn. He served in the Obama administration. And Richard in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Leonard. Hope you feel well.
Thanks. I hope Leonard feels well, too, but I'm trying.
My point is simply this. I think the Obama visit to the Caribbean and natural and normalizing relations with Cuba has less to do with the Cuban people and more to do with the rise of China in the Caribbean. Jamaica, where I'm from, has basically given China an island, and you listeners can Google it. It's called Goat Island in Jamaica. And basically, China is looking to make the largest seaport in the Eastern Hemisphere in Jamaica. And if you look throughout the Caribbean, they're making similar deals where they come in the case of Jamaica, they gave us interstate highways. And in return, they asked back for these favors. And in the case of Jamaica, they're looking to make one square mile port. And the Jamaican people are fighting back, but the fact of the matter is the deal is already done. So I think while we celebrate what Obama has done, it has less to do with what Obama did because he wanted to make normalized relationships with Cuba for the sake of Cuba, and more to stem the rise of the Chinese influence in the Caribbean. Your thoughts,
Mr. Fernandez?
So I think you're bringing up a good point, not necessarily with Cuba, but Latin America has been a focus for China. I think the fact that that Trump is going to do away with the TPP negotiations is making the Chinese quite happy, because they'll have an open door to try and increase their influence in Latin America and the Asia Pacific. China's trade with Latin America has quadrupled in the last decade or so, but it's been a difficult deal, to use that term, for the Latins. It's been a Faustian bargain, in a sense, in that they have been selling raw materials to the Chinese, typically copper, metals, and the like, and the Chinese have sold their consumer goods in Latin America. And so what it's done, it's in many countries, Central America, for example, it's eviscerated local industry. It's done away with the textile industry in many of these countries. So I think it's the Chinese-Latin relationship is one that's evolving. It's one that I think will at some point challenge the U.S. The U.S. is still the largest investor in Latin America and the largest trading partner overall. But I think we have a challenger. And I think part of what will have to be done going forward from the U.S. side is to address some of the benefits that many countries see with trading with China. And China, for many of these countries, does not demand anything in the way of human rights and in the way of democracy. And I think that's something that, from a U.S. foreign policy point of view, is a new challenge that wasn't there before.
I'm glad the caller brought that up. That was really interesting. Andres in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andres.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
I'm calling. I'm Cuban, and I'm someone who supported Fidel for most of my life. My family in Cuba, half my family in Cuba supports Fidel, half of them don't support, totally against him. But I like what Castro's done in terms of his support for black political movements in this country, what he's done for Africa. I've never believed this, most of the white Cubans that have come over here talking about freedom and wanting to find a free country. I've never seen those white Cubans participating in any of the freedom movements over here. I don't see that much participation, unlike Jews, who fled persecution participated in black movements. So I've never seen any of these Cubans participating in movements for freedom over here. They usually align themselves with the powers that be. So I've supported Fidel for the longest time, recognizing that in Cuba they have not adequately addressed racial issues over there. But you know, that's my two cents in that.
Jose, want to talk to Andres?
Sure. So, look, I think clearly Cuba, Castro had great advances in health and education, but it's been a brutal regime, and there's no way around it. It's killed people without trial. It's held people in prisons for 20, 30 years simply because they spoke against the government. And today, it's got political prisoners in Cuba. I think the gains in the Cuban Revolution in health and education were there 10 years, 15 years after the revolution. But after that, it has not improved. And if you look at Cuba, Cuba has been a, quote, you know, a beggar country for most of Castro's existence. It has not been able to feed itself. It's relied first on the Soviet Union and then now on Venezuela, and it's really never been able to stand on its own 2 feet. And yes, there have been advances, but I think most Cubans today, maybe they weren't saying it 30 years ago, but today would want a different regime. And right now, you can't have it because you do not have a democracy. You have someone who does not believe in elections and who uses the U.S. as a way of saying that the democracy cannot come to Cuba, Andres.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, the Cubans from the United States that, you know, are so against the revolution, I never see this same type of concern for political prisoners from these same Cubans in the United States. I never see the same concern for the oppression of committed by police against African Americans in this country. The Cubans that talk so much about the brutality and repression in Cuba, I never see them raising the same kind of a concern for the brutality that exists against African Americans and other oppressed groups in this country. I'm not so sure how concerned they are for democracy and freedom. That's really my thing, because the loudest voices against Cuba are the ones who proclaim to be so in favor of freedom and these kinds of ideals, but they never express these same kinds of concerns
other movements. I get you. Andres, thank you. Please call us again. You know, to that point, we also have a tweet that says, ask your guest why Afro-Cubans aren't cheering the death of Comandante Castro, asks a listener on Twitter. There really is a racial divide, right? I mean, a lot of the Cuban exile families were the whiter Cubans to begin with.
Yeah, that's correct. The early emigres were white. In the last decade or so, it's been much more mixed. Look, Cuba has had a very difficult racial history. You've had massacres of Afro-Cubans at the beginning of the 1900s. You had segregation. You had a number of a lot of discrimination and one of the things that Castro talked about was ending that, and I think to some extent he did. Although if you look at the Cuban Politburo, it's dominated by white men, and I think so. There's a lot of work that remains to be done, but there's no doubt that racial relations with Castro improved, not as much as he says. And then the question for Cubans is, did that justify the killings? Did that justify the imprisonment? Did that justify 55 years or more of a dictatorship?
My guest for another few minutes is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs and native Cuban, Jose Fernandez, who is now the co-chair of the Latin American Practice Group at the law firm Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. This is your first time on the show. You sound like an interesting guy. I love how you're talking about some of the subtleties and some of the nuances, which we don't usually hear when it comes to Cuba. What'd you do in the State Department?
So what I did is I was assistant secretary for the first 4 years of Obama, and then the first year of the second administration. Because of what was going on in the world, I focused mostly on North Africa. We had the Arab Spring, and one of the things that we decided we needed to do was to find ways to create more economic opportunity for young people who were the ones that were really rising up against the old dictatorship. So, you know, on the economic side, I tried to bring entrepreneurs to North Africa. I tried to create opportunities for U.S. businesses to do work there. Not so much for them to make money, although that was obviously something that we welcomed, but also as a way of creating linkages between the Arab populations in North Africa and the United States. And I must say that I tremble at what's going to happen to those policies in the next 4 years.
What's your biggest fear?
I think, we tried. People forget in 2008 George Bush and the Iraq War and what that did to our image in North Africa. We fought hard to try and change that, and I believed. The U.S. could be a beacon of hope for these countries, and I wanted to show the best part of America, the America that I know, the America that welcomes different nationalities, the America that provides opportunity for all. That we're not perfect, but we strive to welcome all. And ask yourself what's going to happen now. And going forward, a number of times I would hear back in places like Algeria and Tunisia and Egypt was, can we trust the U.S.? Is this something? Is this a blip in your foreign policy, or is this something that will continue? And I wonder, how those people who were asking me those questions, how they feel now.
Hmm. Now that you're in the private sector, what's your law practice like? Is it business oriented?
It's business oriented. I basically deal in emerging markets in Latin America, bringing U.S. companies there or having Latin American companies do business in the U.S. And that's what I've done for the last 25 years.
But you were pitched to us as a guest today, so I guess you want to keep your voice in the mix on foreign affairs.
Well, I think it's important. I think the U.S. doesn't have the luxury of just standing back. I think by virtue of our size, by virtue of our history and our economy, we've got to play a role in the world. And I'm hoping that we can play a positive role, a role that I think welcomes all, and that shows other countries the benefits of a democracy and of a debate. And I hopefully that will continue.
Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Jose Fernandez, very nice to talk to you. Hope we can have you on again. Thank you for joining us.
Good talking to you. Take care.